Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today is the 189th birthday of Belva Ann Lockwood, who was born October 24th, 1830, and died at age 86 on May 17th, 1917. In case you might not recognize her name, she is acclaimed as the first woman to appear on official ballots as a candidate for President of the United States of America in 1884 and 1888. Of course, aside from a few technicalities, Victoria Woodhull seems to be the first actual living flesh and blood American woman to run for president in 1872. But Lockwood is credited as the first officially sanctioned human female aspirant for the office of chief executives. She was also the first woman attorney to practice before the U.S. Supreme Court. Belva Lockwood was born in Royalton, New York, and struggled to be allowed a college education as a woman. Law school was even more a rarity for women. She was twice widowed. Her first husband, whom she married at 18, a local farmer, died 5 years later of tuberculosis, leaving her with a daughter. She remarried 15 years later in 1868 to a Baptist minister and Civil War veteran who was much older than she. He was Reverend Ezekiel Lockwood, and he spent the rest of his life assisting her in whatever she did. A daughter was born, but died 2 years later from that marriage. Jill Norgren, a writer and professor emerita of government and legal studies at John Jay College and City University of New York, is the author of Belva Lockwood, An Uncommon Life. She wrote that Lockwood was a self-assured woman who exuded ego. She insisted on the right to prove herself, and she adopted bold positions in support of equal opportunities for women. Lockwood rejected dependency for herself and other women, Norgren wrote, and did not hesitate to confront the male establishment that kept women from voting and from professional advancement. Lockwood endured the extremely anti-woman law school of the era after completing college under the stress of being a single mother and the deep prejudices against women venturing outside the home. She was refused a diploma from law school because of her gender. The male law students demanded the few women not be graduated. So she wrote a letter to President U.S. Grant, and within a week, Lockwood received her law degree. She was 43 years old. The Lockwood Law Office in Washington, D.C., quote, drew a multiracial clientele of laborers, painters, maids, tradesmen, veterans, and owners of small real estate properties, Norgren wrote. Lady Lawyer Lockwood represented clients in the District of Columbia, Maryland, and Virginia. In 1876, the centennial year of American democracy, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to admit Lockwood to its bar, claiming that none but men are permitted to practice before the court as attorneys and counselors, quote, unquote. Lockwood countered by single-handedly lobbying Congress to pass what became known as the Belva Bill, which she wrote, until after a year, both houses adopted, quote, an act to relieve certain legal disabilities of women, unquote. Lockwood was granted status as the first woman admitted to the Supreme Court bar. And a year after that, she was the first woman to argue a case before the High Court, Kaiser versus Stickney. 5 years after opening the bars of the Supreme Court, Lockwood became the first woman to campaign full status for the presidency on the ticket of the National Equal Rights Party in 1884. Her third-party candidacy startled the country and vexed other suffrage leaders, some of whom thought her a Barnum, Jill Norgren wrote in her 2005 book. She believed that her bid for the presidency would help women gain the right to vote and to be accepted into partisan politics, Norgren wrote. She could not vote, Lockwood told the political press of her day, but nothing in the Constitution prevented men from voting for her. Belva Lockwood's political platform was a broad range of policy issues, which included equal political rights, civil service reform, judicial appointments, Native American issues from their perspective, protection of public lands, also temperance, pensions, and the federalization of family law. Lockwood cut a sharp figure and was blessed with a quick mind and tongue, Nordgren wrote. It is not difficult to imagine this no-nonsense woman facing the judge in a room teeming with people, many of them down on their luck. Nor would it be too difficult to imagine Belva Ann Lockwood as the first woman president of the United States, either. She argued that rather than women attempt to ingratiate themselves to male-dominated political parties, quote, it is quite time women had our own party, our own platform, and our own nominee, she said. We women shall never have equal rights until we take them, she said, nor respect until we command it. The National Equal Rights Party officially formed and selected Belva Lockwood as their nominee in 1884 and again in 1888. Her vice presidential running mate was Marietta Stowe, chair of the new Equal Rights Party. Amused by the idea of a woman candidate for president, men all over the United States formed Belva Lockwood clubs and held faux rallies in which cross-dressing men pretended to be Lockwood and her supporters, holding farcical rallies and parades complete with falsely feminine speeches. Representing a third party without a broad base of support, Lockwood did not have a serious chance of winning. Since women were denied the right to vote by law, and most newspapers and magazines, the mass media of its time, opposed her candidacy, it was probably unusual for her to receive many votes. Male voters were warned of petticoat rule if Belva Lockwood were elected president. Lockwood petitioned Congress to have the votes for her counted, and she told the media that she had evidence of voter fraud. She said supporters had claimed to have seen their ballots ripped up. Lockwood claimed that she received one half the electoral vote of Oregon and a large vote in Pennsylvania. But the votes in the latter state were not counted, simply dumped into wastebaskets as false votes, Lockwood wrote in an article in National Magazine in 1903, How I Ran for the Presidency. Although Victoria Woodhull was the first woman known to openly campaign for the presidency in 1872, many disputes remain about her eligibility. She was not yet 35 when she campaigned, and there were doubts about the bona fides of the party she claimed to be candidate of. Belva Lockwood was the first woman whose name appeared on official ballots of the Equal Rights Party. Somewhat ironically, on Lockwood's second run for the presidency, her vice presidential nominee was Charles S. Weld, who was, apparently, a nephew-in-law to Victoria Woodhull. And that was Belva Ann Lockwood. And I wish her a posthumous happy birthday. And 3 days from now would be my mother's posthumous birthday. She would be 107. Josephine Anna Maria Campuchani was born October 27, 1912, about 2 weeks before Woodrow Wilson was elected President of the United States. She died at 95 in 2008. She turned 54 the October I was in Vietnam. Her birthday that year, 1966, is one I remember most of all. I dedicate this also to Clifford McKenzie, old friend from USMC Vietnam Insanity, who died this past week in New York City. Happy birthday, Mother. The following story took place on October 27, 1966. Monsoon winds blew down from China one afternoon in late October and swept across the mountains of the Annamite Cordillera, the spinal cord of Vietnam. Huge columns of rain clouds, the winds freighted from the South China Sea, massed above sharp jungled peaks and streamed through high shallow valleys that were terraced with rice fields or were wild and uninhabited. Rays of sunlight shot through the clouds like shifting cannon fire into wood-blown trees and palms that broke the shafts into spiked prisms and shadows. The wind was cold, and rain from the advancing clouds hammered the jungled ridges with a heavy roar, flooding valleys and peeling away the mottled walls of primitive homes built of mud and thatch, which were bunched together in lonely villages. Rain relentlessly poured down upon a haggard and straggled column of armed and helmeted men who were sliding down the muddy ridges toward a village in one of the smaller valleys. I was among them, second in the ragged file, and followed the point man into the valley. I was able to see the village beyond a maze of rain-swollen paddies, enclosed by walls of hedgerows and palms that were whipped by the wind. It was a skimpy place, wretchedly poor, as were most villages in the mountains. The farmers and their families lived a harsh existence and were killed early by disease, exhaustion, and hunger. In a sense, they were a frontier people who had left their culture in the overcrowded coastal plains and settled on its rough fringes among Stone Age tribes they loathed and feared in much the manner of my own ancestors among the Western Indians. The village was an island amidst an ocean of drowned rice fields and seemed suspended in a history of approaching armies. I looked back at the other Marines stumbling down from the muddy ridges and saw their reflections in the brackish water of the rectangular paddies, cast against the salt and pepper sky like etchings of war gods. I noticed the point man was having a hard time crossing the valley along the spines of paddy dikes that collapsed under the weight of his feet. He was a short, fat man, hunched in his labored walk in the sucking mud, and were it not for his clothes and helmet, I might have mistaken him for one of the small apes that lived on the higher slopes. His back was bent, his hands grasped his knees and pushed his legs to drive them like sluggish pistons, one slippery step after another. His rifle swung loosely from a sling draped over his right shoulder and bruised his hip every move of his legs. His red, jowly face was haggard, almost cadaverous, shriveled like an old orange under the green and brown dappled steel bowl that covered his head, which swiveled from side to side, almost mechanically. His chin and nose arched as if he was literally sniffing whatever might be ahead or around, an ambush hidden in the trees and bushes, a sniper in a palm tree taking aim. He abruptly dropped his head every few moments to detect explosives, landmines or booby traps that might have been planted in the fields after the rice harvest a month earlier. His head seemed almost as loose as his rifle, and I would not have been surprised if it turned completely around and stared at me. The thought hardly formed. A shot cracked from the village. Its flat echo was the sound of a popped paper bag. At the same instant, the point man splashed backward into a paddy. A silence as sudden as the shot lasted only a second. Most of the other Marines dropped to the ground and started firing rifles and machine guns into the village. I discovered myself half submerged in water and mud, choking on slime and vomit. I tried to focus my eyes on something to shoot at, but saw only a small hill I had not noticed before. After a few seconds, I realized it was the point man's rounded stomach, sticking out of the water like a dumpling in stew. A voice bellowed over the gunfire and it raggedly ceased. The voice shouted again and the Marines behind me began to withdraw back to the ridge. Three of us ran to the point man and started carrying him. He was dead. A hole in his right cheek blew out the back of his head, which dripped blood and brains after we lifted him from the paddy. But he had not taken an ounce of weight with him when he died. Our initial attempt to run slowed quickly to a lurching walk. I had his legs and pushed at him as if he were a wheelbarrow, desperate to get out of range of a second shot. We finally reached the other Marines, dropped his body next to a tree, and covered him with a poncho. We spread out along the ridge bottom, which was heavily brushed, and pointed our weapons at the village. An officer crouched against an embankment and shouted into a radio for an airstrike. He shouted again at another officer who was trying to locate the village on a rain-soaked map and shouted back into the radio. We waited for the jets like executioners. The village was almost completely obscured by the rain and by fogs rising from the fields. It appeared and disappeared as if straining to vanish before it was found by bombs, to become as much a phantom as the man or woman who had killed the point man. Two phantom jets came at sunset. The rain had stopped with a suddenness usual in the tropics, and the sky was rouged through holes in the darkening clouds. The jets streaked down from the tops of the mountains and flew straight for the village just above the mist that blanketed the fields. They barely cleared the trees as they dropped aluminum canisters of napalm. Great jellied globes of fire erupted from all over the village, instantly swallowed by billows of black smoke that were immediately consumed by a terrible heat. The village caught fire. Houses exploded into flame. Their thatched roofs burst into the air. Palm trees flared into torches. Even the mists in the fields were burned away, and we who cowered at the bottom of a slope were slapped by the heat. The jets rolled back and came again. They dived down the same ridges and across the fields and dropped their last canisters into the flaming village. I stared at the fires. I felt the stinging heat against my nose and eyes and smelled the acrid smoke blown off the fires by the wind. Helicopter gunships flew in a few minutes after the jets left, and though they were tossed wildly by the wind, they careened over the paddies like large dragonflies. I heard the heavy clatter of their machine guns as they shot up the fields on the other side of the village. Two helicopters shot rockets into the burning village, then raked it with machine gun fire. A single helicopter broke off and flew towards us and landed next to green smoke, erupting from a grenade tossed by an officer into the paddy in front of us. The point man's body was heaved into its open side door like a piece of rubbish. The helicopter lifted unsteadily into the air and with a great burst of power swung onto its side and arched around the mountain and flew across the wind. It rejoined its flock, which climbed over the jungled mountains and followed the jets southeast to the coast. We were left alone again. The sounds of machines and guns were replaced by final explosions of the fires in the village. We waited until they burned down and crossed the paddies at dusk. The wind blew into our faces and stung our eyes with smoke and ashes. A thin man led us this time. He took us past burnt animal pens, each with its own dead water buffalo. The blackened stalks of palm trees towered above us as we entered the ruined village. We first came upon an old man whose skin was burned green and black. He lay on a raised bed of wood that was charred and smoking. He wore a tattered purple robe that had caught on fire but was not completely burned. His eyes were closed. Flies buzzed around his open mouth. His stiffened arms and hands were raised toward the sky. The wind blew at his scorched white hair. We next passed an elderly man and woman whose bodies lay curled like fruit peelings in front of a house that had burned to a bed of glowing coals. The thin man hacked through a wall of broken and smoking bushes with a machete. We emerged from the ruined hedgerow into a stone courtyard that was bordered on three sides by a lone stone wall. At its center was a house, its white walls built of stucco and mud topped by a peaked clay cobbled roof that had partially collapsed. The walls were stained by moss and in parts overgrown with vines, some of which had been set afire. The courtyard was filled with the bodies of children. Some of them were horribly burned or mangled. Others seemed only asleep, their skins a bright cherry color as if they had merely been sunburned. A few bodies were not complete, and others more than one, possibly fused by heat. There were at least a score of them, older children, young children, and babies. I stopped and stared at them. I tried to walk away, but I could not move. I did not want to look at them, but I was horrified and could not stop staring. I almost vomited the same instant my eyes filled with tears. My mind started to unstick. Thin calluses that had spread over my sensibilities blistered and ruptured like scabs of wounds. I was engulfed in despair and shame. Ugly sights of broken children in cities and villages superimposed over the bodies, starved and emaciated children whose arms or legs were fly-infested stumps, whose small bodies were raw and bleeding from wounds and sores, who begged and stole for food like desperate young wolves and died alone and unmourned, sometimes murdered by each other. I tried to shut them out of my eyes for months. I had deafened my ears to their screams and pleas, but they persistently haunted my thoughts and filled my dreams. I knew instantly and with chilling horror that the dead children in the courtyard had been displayed there intentionally, carried from all parts of the burning village by survivors who fled into the fields away from us, perhaps many of them killed by the helicopters that hunted in the wake of the jets on the far side of the valley. My friend Willie Mack stopped and stood with me over the bodies. His eyes were empty, his gaunt face expressionless. Marines passed us and moved deeper into the ravaged village. Their rifles darted nervously like snakes searching for prey. A few looked at the children. Most tried not to. They did not want to add these deaths to their imperiled lives. They saved their sympathy for themselves. They left them for us, I said almost in a whisper. I felt Willie Mack's sudden hard gripping of my arm, pulling me away. Come on, he said, it's no good. I stumbled along with him through the broken village. We came across more bodies, steaming with flies, and in some instances parts of bodies, and the bodies of several dead pigs, dogs, and water buffalo that had been cremated in pens behind burnt houses. We found some Marines sitting on the hard dirt floor of a partially roofed house, which was fringed by a grove of blackened palm trees. Find some place to crap out, one of the Marines said. We're staying the night. We shared the village with the dead Vietnamese, who remained where they died. Heavy rain fell most of the night. I leaned against the door frame of a house that was not completely destroyed and stared out into the dark toward the moldy courtyard and the dead children. My vision was obscured by smashed, burnt dwellings and hedgerows, and by the ghostly density of rain and fogs that rose from the mud and were whipped by the wind into tattered streamers that seemed to be souls leaving the dead, wreathing around the scattered ashes of their homes a final moment before vanishing into the stormy sky. I imagined the bodies of the children, withered and curled like leaves fallen from trees, pounded by monsoon rains into compost, their blood leached by the rain, their horrible burns cooled and softened. I turned and shouted into the darkness of the house, "Why didn't they get the hell out of here? They knew we were coming. They knew we'd blow them up." "Shut up," Willie Mack hissed. "You almost got yourself convinced it's their own fault they're dead." "B.S. You probably wouldn't even give a damn if you hadn't seen the kids." "I've seen kids blown away." "Sure, but not like this," he said quietly. "You're scared. You think those kids are your death warrant. You think they're going to get you for this. What about the sniper?" "What about him? All he did was pop one of our boys. We turned their kids into torches." Of course he was right. I was terrified by the hatred behind the display of the dead children and at the vengeance their deaths demanded. I felt I would be hunted down for their murders, and if I escaped Vietnam, that eventually my own mind would be the hunter. I smoked a cigarette and rolled into a poncho on the floor of the house, but was unable to sleep. I lay awake for a long time and finally became aware that it was my mother's birthday. I had forgotten. Perhaps the dead children reminded me. I wondered if any of their mothers remained alive, and I felt again my fear of their grief and hatred. "Happy birthday, mother," I whispered. "Your kids are dead." "You say something," Willie Mack's sleepy voice croaked. "I was thinking about my mother." "You're a cesspool of neuroses." "I just remembered it's her birthday." "Happy birthday, mother," Willie Mack said. The next day we left the dead village and climbed the mountains on the far side of the valley. And that was something I wrote, "Happy Birthday, Mother." And now, by Jody Rosen, "Staring Down Donald Trump, the Same Elephant in Every Room." Every now and then, the internet coughs up a viral video that has the quality of found art. It may be jittery amateur iPhone footage. It may be a spontaneous moment captured by a pool photographer covering a news event, but it has the elegance and integrity and uncanny formal symmetry of something scripted. One remarkable example is a recent video of the teenage climate activist Greta Thunberg, shot at the United Nations in New York on the morning of September 23rd. The clip begins with Thunberg standing at the edge of a lobby crowded with onlookers and reporters. The camera is tightly focused on her face, and we watch that face transform. Thunberg's eyes narrow and harden. Her mouth twists into a skeptical scowl. Suddenly, the camera whizzes back to reveal the object of her glare. President Trump has entered the room. He is flanked by aides and dignitaries, and his mouth is moving rapidly, as it often does. But what seizes our attention is Trump's imposing physical presence in the foreground of a shot. We watch him move with an imperious rhinocerine trudge into the center of the frame until he obscures our view of Thunberg almost altogether. The sequence lasts only a few seconds, but it is a complete narrative, a story told so deftly, with such faithlessness to Aristotelian dramatic principles, that it's hard to believe that it wasn't cooked up in Hollywood. The blocking, the beats, the zipping camera movement, and especially the exaggerated actions and reactions of the protagonists. The episode even had a foreshadowing prologue. That morning, in a speech to the world leaders gathered at the United Nations Climate Action Summit, Thunberg delivered a warning. "My message is that we will be watching you," she said. "The eyes of all future generations are upon you." And there she was, not long afterward, fixing the planet's most notorious climate change denier with the internet quickly deemed a death stare. The video rocketed around the internet, generating memes and quips, none of them especially clever. The eagerness of so many to claim Thunberg as their glowering proxy was curious. That withering death stare was directed at Trump, but was it directed only at Trump? Thunberg's message, reiterated that day in her speech at the United Nations, is a broad generational indictment that spares no one, at least no one over 18, for their empty words and inactions on the climate crisis. The countless thousands who have crammed social media feeds with variations on the theme, "We are all Greta Thunberg," are seeking an absolution that Thunberg is not offering. In fact, the viral popularity of this video may have little to do with climate change or with the scouring power of Thunberg's gaze. The clip concisely encapsulates an experience to which millions of us can relate. The key moment comes with that abrupt shift in focal point when the camera seems to jump up and flee, zooming away from Thunberg to document the arrival of the president. It is a jarring bait and switch, a visual joke with a grim punchline. Thunberg is a small person, but a mighty moral force. Trump, it seems fair to assert, is in both respects Thunberg's antithesis. Yet the camera is drawn away. She is eclipsed by the person of Trump, who heaves into the center of the frame like one of those giant cruise ships. Famous, powerful people are known to make grand entrances. It is part of the gig. But Trump's way of lurching into a room is inseparable from his propensity for creating chaos and obliterating meaning. "Thank you very much. Thank you very much," he booms as he steps into the United Nations lobby. He seems to be addressing this thanks to everyone in the room, as if all those present have just burst into applause. They haven't. He is merely being Trump, doing what he does when he shows up any place, subjugating the entire purpose of the event to his own ego and id. It is a demeanor that announces that if anything is going to get done today, it will happen in spite, probably in defiance, of the President of the United States. Trump wound up attending the climate meeting for about 15 minutes. There were more pressing matters to attend to. He posted on Twitter a dozen times that day, including tweets mocking Mitt Romney, Joe Biden, and Adam Schiff. He also directed a trolling tweet at Thunberg. "She seems like a very happy young girl looking forward to a bright and wonderful future. So nice to see," quote unquote. We are not all Greta Thunberg, but all of us know what it's like to be ambushed by Donald Trump. He pops up on your social media feed with hateful words and impulsive policy announcements. He flickers on TV screens in bus terminals and airport departure lounges, forever looming over your shoulder. He barges unbidden into your dreams. Even the president's most dedicated enablers scan the sky warily, awaiting today's cyclone, the next reckless, capricious twist of the plot. The door swings open. The president enters. All heads turn. The camera whips around, and suddenly, everything else, better angels, higher ideals, common decency, common sense, beauty, truth, blurs into the background. This is Michael McCusker.